Well, good morning, everybody, and welcome. This is an open meeting of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board on May 24th, 2007. We welcome those of you who have joined us today, both in person and listening to the webcast of this meeting. Today, the board will consider a recommendation to adopt a new auditing standard that would supersede the board's existing standard on auditing internal control over financial reporting, as well as several related amendments. In addition, the board will also consider recommendations concerning the board's rules on inspection frequency for smaller firms. Before we proceed with the specific agenda items today, I will note for the record that all members are present at today's meeting. The first order of business before the board today is a staff recommendation that the board adopt a new internal control auditing standard and related proposals. This July will mark the fifth anniversary of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act, and much has happened since July 2002. When many people refer to Sarbanes-Oxley, they are in fact referring to Section 404, which sets forth new provisions related to internal control over financial reporting for all U.S. public companies. As over 50% of U.S. households are now equity holders in one form or another, Congress mandated in Section 404A that CEOs and CFOs of companies choosing to access U.S. public markets should have to disclose to investors whether their company's internal control over financial reporting is effective. In Section 404B, Congress mandated an audit of internal control. Even though Congress has acted in the area of internal control more than once before, the Act's requirements for quarterly management certifications, annual management assessment of controls, and independent auditor attestations of these assessments raise corporate responsibility for internal control over financial reporting to a higher level. On the heels of the corporate scandals that surged in 2000 and 2001, there was a broad-based sentiment that these enhanced requirements were necessary to restore integrity to and confidence in financial reporting. The PCAOB has been focused on the implementation of the internal control audit for the past several years. Since adopting auditing standard number 2 in 2004, the board has closely monitored its implementation. In May of last year, before I joined the board, my board colleagues, all of whom were here at the time, made a commitment to revisit AS2, and we're here today, 1 year and 1 week since that commitment was made, to consider a new standard to replace it. The PCAOB's action today is a reflection of the board's belief in the importance of internal control to reliable financial reporting. With so many investors in the United States and around the world invested in U.S. companies, we owe it to them to see that there is a quality audit over internal control within these companies. At the same time, investors and public companies alike benefit from regulatory balance. Therefore, the PCAOB has been driven by the need to identify changes that would preserve the important benefits of the standard and meet the statutory objectives of the Act without resulting in the performance of unnecessary audit procedures. In December, at our open meeting, I emphasized the need for a standard that would help bring about a better alignment between the costs and benefits of the internal control audit. With regard to benefit, I am encouraged that many companies that are now subject to Section 404 are starting to show the benefit of internal control over financial reporting. The first 2 years of their reporting on internal controls tells us a great deal about the progress made already, and findings for year three appear to support a continuing positive trend. While the costs of internal controls have seized attention, we should not lose sight of the visible benefits. An analysis of reporting data indicates an encouraging trend. For example, from the first year of compliance with Section 404 to the second, there was a decline in the overall number of opinions in ICFR that describe material weaknesses. The results as of April 1, 2007, indicate that this trend is continuing in year three. Restatements are also declining for companies subject to Section 404, which is in contrast with the restatement rate for those not yet subject to its requirements. This suggests that internal control over financial reporting is helping companies identify and fix problems in advance of having to restate. These signs of benefits are encouraging. I'm also encouraged by what I hear from corporate America. The consistent feedback that I get from corporate board members and CEOs of accelerated filers is that there are better companies today due to internal control over financial reporting, but they continue to express concern about unnecessary burden. Last December, the board proposed for Comet a new standard in auditing internal control that would replace auditing standard number 2. At that time, I encouraged auditors, investors, issuers, and all others who rely on corporate financial statements to tell us whether the proposals clarified board expectations, reduced unnecessary work, and retained the important benefits of an audit of internal control. The public comment process for a standard of this significance is tremendously important. The comments received, 175 in all, further informed our thinking. The standard and related rule and amendments that we are considering today reflect our careful consideration of the comments. We're grateful to the array of commenters who took the time to provide their analysis. The board asks staff to scrutinize the comments against the provisions of the proposed standard with the goal of eliminating unnecessary requirements for internal control reporting while developing a standard that will require auditors to obtain sufficient evidence to provide an opinion on a company's internal controls. We have carefully studied the comments and received so that the recommendations before us today reflect the full benefit of the comment period. We have also worked closely with counterparts at the SEC to ensure that the recommendations are consistent with the guidance provided by the Commission at its open meeting in April, which included the importance of appropriately coordinating the standard with the SEC's management guidance adopted at the SEC's open meeting yesterday. This alignment is important to auditors and issuers. In a moment, Thomas Ray, our Chief Auditor and Director of Professional Standards, and his team will present to the board the staff's recommendations for a final standard to replace AS2, a related independence rule, and conforming amendments to the board's auditing standards. I commend Tom and the staff for their intellectual fortitude and old-fashioned hard work, which has brought the standard and its related rule and amendment before the board today. Staff has worked creatively to find solutions and has been steadfast when it mattered most. To present the staff's recommendation on this agenda item, I'll now turn to Tom Ray. Tom.
Thank you and good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. My colleagues from the Office of the Chief Auditor and I are very pleased to be with you this morning to recommend that you adopt a new auditing standard, an audit of internal control over financial reporting that is integrated with an audit of financial statements. This auditing standard, if adopted by you and approved by the Securities and Exchange Commission, will replace the board's auditing standard number 2. Accompanying the new auditing standard are two related recommendations. One is a new independence rule addressing the pre-approval by the audit committee of internal control-related non-audit services. That is a revision of the independence requirement currently in auditing standard number 2. The other recommendation consists of certain amendments to the board's auditing standards, most of which are to conform those standards to the standard and rule we are recommending that the board adopt this morning. In a few minutes, Laura Phillips, Deputy Chief Auditor, and Sharon Virag, Associate Chief Auditor, will outline the more notable areas of change from the standards, rule, and amendments the board proposed for comment on December 19th of last year, and some of the significant features of the final standard, including how those features compare to auditing standard number 2. There are several aspects of our recommendations in the process of finalizing them that I would first like to discuss. In preparing the final recommendation that is before you, we kept our focus on the substantial benefits investors have received from improved internal control over financial reporting. The auditing standard, independence rule, and related amendments we will recommend that you adopt today have been evaluated against that objective. When the board announced its plan in May of last year to amend its internal control auditing standard, the board stated that it would preserve the principles of auditing standard number 2. I am pleased to be able to tell you today that those principles have indeed been preserved in our recommendation. Most importantly, the new internal control auditing standard requires the auditor to obtain reasonable assurance about whether material weaknesses exist in the company's internal control. A single audit framework, one that is scalable based on factors related to a company's size and complexity, would apply to all companies that must have their internal control audited in accordance with this standard. As you noted, Mr. Chairman, we received many thoughtful comment letters on our proposals, and I would like to thank those who wrote to us for taking the time to develop and send us their comments. We also were able to dedicate the February meeting of our standing advisory group, which occurred prior to the end of our public comment period, to obtain advice on our proposals. And in April, the Securities and Exchange Commission held a public meeting to discuss our proposed internal control auditing standard. Our final recommendations have therefore benefited from substantial public comment, advice from our standing advisory group, and input from the Commission and its staff. When the Board proposed a revised internal control auditing standard in December of last year, it stated that the proposed new standard was a principles-based standard designed to focus the auditor on the most important matters. In arriving at its proposal, the Board eliminated procedures it believed were unnecessary to an effective audit of internal control. Several commenters pointed out, however, that the proposal contained approximately 250, although Sharon tells me it's 247, mandatory or presumptively mandatory obligations, suggesting perhaps that the proposal was not as principles-based as advertised. So one of the things we did in responding to the comments and other input we received was to re-challenge each of those obligations and the level of detail in the proposed standards provisions. Now, I don't have for you today a revised number of the use of the terms must and should in the new auditing standard, although I do have a high degree of confidence somebody is going to advise us of that number fairly soon. But the number is reduced. Now, the number of those obligations is by itself not that important. The time we spent refocusing on them, however, was highly beneficial. The enhancements we have made to the proposal in arriving at this final recommendation have the effect of further helping auditors to focus on the objectives of the internal control audit and on what is most important to effective internal control over financial reporting. So what are those things that are most important? One of them is the prevention or timely detection of fraudulent financial reporting, and we have received some very thoughtful comment in this area. As one commenter stated, ensuring adequate controls that prevent senior management from cooking the books must be a focus of control assessment. We enhance the direction on the auditor's evaluation of whether the company's controls sufficiently address identified risks of material misstatement due to fraud and controls intended to address the risk of management override of other controls. We also reposition that direction to make it even more clear that the focus on fraud is an integral part of the identification and testing of entity level and other company controls. Additionally, we strengthen the direction on entity level controls, in particular the control environment in the period end financial reporting process. In summary, by focusing the auditor's attention on those matters that are most important to effective internal control, this new internal control auditing standard presents another significant opportunity to strengthen the financial reporting process. Before I turn the floor over to Laura and Sharon, I would like to take a few moments to recognize some of the people who have made significant contributions to this project. Sharon Bierug was the leader on this project. She led us with grace and determination, and her spirit and dedication inspired us all. Thank you, Sharon. Laura Phillips, as you know, advised us several weeks ago of her desire to change the direction of her career and will soon be leaving the PCAOB. Laura, your dedication to the PCAOB mission will be missed. Your intellect will be missed, and I wish you all the best for the future. So, what was Laura's contribution to this project? In its final weeks, one might ask.
Yeah.
Well, there's no question those walking the halls of the PCAOB, no question in their minds of that contribution. Laura's contribution was immense, and I'm grateful for her willingness to help bring this project to completion. So thank you, Sharon and Laura, for your focus on and dedication to this important project. Sam Guzman from the Office of the Chief Auditor and Dima Andrienko, a member of the PCAOB Inspections Division who is participating in a residency program in the Office of the Chief Auditor, also has made significant contributions. Others I would like to recognize are the members of our Office of General Counsel, notably Jake Lesser, who provided us with sound advice throughout each phase of the project, board members and their advisors, all of whom have provided their support, insights, and inspiration, reviewers in our divisions of inspection and research and analysis, and personnel in our Office of External Affairs. My other colleagues in the Office of the Chief Auditor also cheerfully heeded our calls for help and have been extraordinarily patient with us. I also would like to thank all of those responsible for pulling together this public meeting. Finally, I would like to recognize our friends at the Securities and Exchange Commission. They have put in many hours in support of this project. At the same time, they were finishing their project to provide guidance to company management, and I congratulate them on the completion of their important project. I will now turn the floor over to Laura Phillips to describe additional details of our recommendation.
Thank you, Tom. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. As Tom has already mentioned, we've made several important improvements to the standard we proposed last December, and I'd like to highlight some of those for you. The need to align the board's standard with the SEC guidance was one of the most frequent comments we received on our proposal. We have worked very closely with the staff at the SEC to make sure that certain terms are coordinated between our standard and the guidance for management that the SEC approved yesterday. For example, we have aligned the definitions of material weakness and significant deficiency and coordinated our lists of indicators of material weakness and discussion of entity-level controls. The coordination included us changing from referring to company-level controls to instead refer to entity-level controls. In making these changes, we have been mindful of the inherent differences in the roles of management and the auditor. Management's daily interaction with its internal control system provides it with knowledge and information that may influence its judgments about how best to evaluate internal control and the sufficiency of evidence it needs for its annual assessment. The auditor is required to provide an independent opinion on the effectiveness of the company's internal control. The auditor does not have the familiarity with the company's controls that management does and does not interact with these controls with the same frequency as management. Therefore, the auditor cannot obtain sufficient evidence to support an opinion on the effectiveness of internal control based solely on observation or interaction with the company's controls. Rather, the auditor needs to perform procedures such as inquiry, observation, and inspection of documents or walkthroughs. We also continued to challenge the areas of prescriptive detail in the standard and are recommending some additional refinements to what was proposed. The proposed standard was organized around a top-down approach. The standard we are recommending today follows that same structure, but with some modifications to the top-down approach. Specifically, we recommend eliminating the identification of significant processes and major classes of transactions from the top-down approach. This change is meant to allow auditors to apply more professional judgment as they work through the top-down approach described in the standard. However, the endpoint would be the same as in the proposed standard, selecting controls to test that address the assessed risk of misstatement to each relevant assertion. Entity-level controls were emphasized in the proposed standard because of their importance both to the auditor's ability to take full advantage of the top-down approach and to effective internal control itself. To continue that emphasis and also provide additional guidance on the subject of entity-level controls, we have included in today's standard a discussion of three broad categories of entity-level controls, which vary in nature and precision, along with an explanation of how each category might have a different effect on the performance of tests of other controls. The staff also reconsidered the requirement to perform a walkthrough of each significant process. The walkthrough requirement was included in auditing standard number 2 and the board's December proposal because there are certain objectives that must be achieved for the auditor to verify that he or she has a sufficient understanding of the likely sources of misstatement and to properly identify the controls to test. We believe that, in some instances, the requirement to perform a walkthrough may have overshadowed the objectives it was meant to achieve. This may have resulted in some walkthroughs being performed to meet the requirement, but failing to achieve the intended purpose. The standard that we are recommending to you today, therefore, focuses on achieving certain important objectives, and the performance requirement is based on fulfilling those objectives as they relate to understanding likely sources of misstatement and the selection of controls to test. While a walkthrough will frequently be the best way of attaining these goals, the auditor's focus should be on the objectives, not the mechanics of a walkthrough. This approach has the benefit of allowing additional flexibility for the auditor to address the facts and circumstances of a particular audit, but more importantly, should focus auditors on performing procedures necessary to achieve these objectives, rather than rote compliance with the requirements of the standard. Next, I'd like to talk about the importance of scaling the audit to the size and complexity of the company being audited. The proposed standard included a section specifically on scaling the audit for smaller and less complex companies. The standard we are recommending today also includes discussion of these topics, but integrates them throughout the standard. Specifically, notes to certain paragraphs describe how to tailor the audit to the particular circumstances of smaller, less complex companies or business units. We have retained the list of attributes of smaller and less complex companies and explicitly acknowledged that even within larger companies, some business units or processes may be less complex than others. The discussion of these attributes has been incorporated into the section on the auditor's planning procedures. Finally, I would like to discuss the changes we are recommending regarding using the work of others. In December, the board also proposed an auditing standard entitled Considering and Using the Work of Others in an Audit that would have superseded the board's interim standard, AU Section 322, the auditor's consideration of the internal audit function in an audit of financial statements, and replaced the direction on using the work of others in an audit of internal control in Auditing Standard 2. The staff is no longer recommending the proposed auditing standard and has instead incorporated the most important integration aspects directly into the new internal control auditing standard. Further, we are recommending that AU Section 322 be retained. We continue to believe that a single framework for the auditor's use of the work of others is preferable, and that for the most part, AU Section 322 can serve as that framework. Consistent with the December proposal, the auditing standard that we are recommending today allows the auditor to use the work of others to obtain evidence about the design and operating effectiveness of controls, and eliminates the principal evidence provision. Recognizing that issuers might employ personnel other than internal auditors to perform activities related to management's assessment of internal control, the standard you have before you allows the auditor to use the work of company personnel other than internal auditors, as well as third parties working under the direction of management or the audit committee, for purposes of testing internal control, both in the audit of internal control and the audit of the financial statements. We believe that this approach will achieve the board's goals of permitting use of the work of others that is appropriate, while at the same time encouraging better integration. I've highlighted noteworthy changes that we are recommending from the December proposal. At this point, Sharon Virag will highlight important changes between Auditing Standard 2 and the new standard that we are recommending today.
Thank you, Laura. Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the board. It is indeed a pleasure to be here today before you. You've heard from Tom and Laura about the key changes to the internal control proposal that the staff recommends. Now we'd like to take a moment to step back and review with you where that takes us from the board's original standard, AS2. The magnitude of change from AS2 to AS5 should not be underestimated. The staff has taken to heart the board's instructions to write a new standard, one that improves the implementation of the requirements of Section 404, but retains the key underlying principles necessary to achieve a quality audit of internal control. The new standard we present today is premised on the board's four overarching objectives established at the beginning of this process: to focus on what's most important, to eliminate unnecessary procedures, scale the audit for size and complexity, and simplify the standard. In a nutshell, the new standard tells auditors to focus on areas of greatest risk that a company's internal control will fail to prevent or detect a material misstatement. It tells them to use a top-down approach and to focus first on the big problem areas that can have a pervasive effect on internal control over financial reporting. for example, the financial statement close process and fraud prevention controls. It describes a risk-based approach and how within that approach, auditors can consider a range of possible combinations of procedures to obtain the evidence necessary according to the assessed level of risk. It also describes how to leverage valuable knowledge accumulated in previous year's audits in the auditor's assessment of risk. We've examined every word in auditing standard number 2, more than once, I might add, to determine where it might encourage auditors to perform procedures that were not instrumental to achieving the bottom line of the audit, determining whether internal control is effective being that bottom line. For example, the new standard eliminates the detailed requirements to evaluate management's own assessment process. It also makes clear that the auditor is not required to give an opinion on the adequacy of management's process. The new standard also tells auditors to look at quality, not quantity, in auditing a company with multiple locations, focusing on higher risk areas rather than on higher coverage by removing the large portion requirement. Laura described the approach to scaling in the new standard. The next step is for planned guidance for auditors of smaller, less complex companies. We're foreshadowing that guidance and aligning with it in the new standard by explaining how to tailor an internal control audit to the size and complexity of the company. The guidance for auditors will develop these themes even further than what we have in the current standard. In the area of simplifying the standard, many commenters suggested that the board make the standard understandable by a larger audience. We saw the virtue in this, and were able to make the new standard much shorter and clearer. For example, we found simpler terms to describe procedures and definitions, and we organized the document to follow the natural flow of a typical audit. And in doing so, we focused on the basics and moved definitions and other background information to the appendices. Finally, key terms such as material weakness, entity-level controls, which we now use instead of company-level controls, and charge a quarter for anyone who still says company-level controls, those were aligned with the SEC's management guidance to avoid any misunderstanding between the auditor and management. Next, I'll briefly talk about the independence rule and conforming amendments that we are recommending to you today. We recommend the board adopt independence rule 3525 as proposed. This rule replaces a similar provision in AS2 that facilitates an informed decision by the audit committee about how the auditor's performance of non-audit internal control-related services may affect the auditor's independence. Based on the feedback the board received on this issue during the comment period, we do not believe that any changes are necessary. Final piece of the package we are recommending to the board this morning is a set of conforming amendments to the board's auditing standards. These amendments accomplish several objectives. They simplify the new internal control standard by moving some information contained in AS2 to other germane interim standards or other standards of the board. They update AS2 references in the other standards to point to relevant paragraphs in AS5, and they change the guidance on dating the auditor's report. AS5, as we are recommending it to you, requires the auditor to date the report no earlier than the date by which the auditor has obtained sufficient competent evidence to support the opinion. This amendment will also change the report date for audits of only the financial statements. Regarding the effective date, the staff recommends that the board adopt the auditing internal control standard as auditing standard number 5. The related independence rule, the conforming amendments to the board's existing standards, with an effective date for audits of fiscal years ending on or after November 15, 2007. Early adoption would be permitted as soon as the standard is approved by the SEC. Additionally, any auditor who elects not to early adopt, meaning they continue to use auditing standard number 2 after the SEC has approved AS5, but before AS5 is required by law, would be required to use the AS5 definition of material weakness, which is the same as the SEC definition approved yesterday. That concludes our remarks. We would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much, Tom, Laura, and Sharon. Are there any motions regarding this matter?
Mr. Chairman, I have a motion.
Mr. Gradison.
Mr. Chairman, I move that the board adopt the auditing standard related independence rule and conforming amendments as recommended, and instruct the staff to submit them to the Securities and Exchange Commission for approval pursuant to Section 107 of the Sarbanes-Oxley Act.
Is there a second?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to second Mr. Gradisson's motion.
The motion has been made and seconded. Thank you, Mr. Gradisson, Mr. Gelzer. The motion has been made and seconded. So the question before the board is whether it will approve the motion and adopt the internal control auditing standard, related independence rule, and conforming amendments, and submit them to the Securities and Exchange Commission for approval. Before I ask my fellow board members for their comments, I would like to express my sincere gratitude to Tom Ray, Laura Phillips, Sharon Virag, Sam Guzman, Dima Andrienko, Gordon Seymour, Jake Lesser, and all the other staff involved in this important initiative for their hard work over the past year on the new standard, and particularly Laura. Thank you so much. I join Tom in sharing in wishing you a well from all of us in your new adventure.
Thank you.
As we move from the proposed stage to a final standard, these individuals have maintained a remarkably high level of commitment. I'd also like to recognize the commitment of my fellow board members. Each board member has invested a tremendous amount of time in the effort to develop the final standard. Each has been engaged in every important issue involved. The board dialogue has helped to illuminate issues of significance and develop viable solutions. I'd like to thank each of you for your role in crafting this standard. The standard that the board will consider today reinforces the board's expectation that the integrated audit be conducted in a manner that eliminates procedures that are unnecessary to an effective audit of internal control and increases the likelihood that material weaknesses will be found before they allow material misstatements to occur. The new statement should drive important improvements in the audit of internal control. In my view, the standard, rule, and related amendments that Tom Ray and his team have just described meets the objective set forth in the four-point plan issued by the board on May of 2006. Importantly, the package before us today is also responsive to the comments received on the proposals and the guidance provided by the SEC, and I'd like to acknowledge our SEC counterparts who are here with us today. I'd like to acknowledge the important and open dialogue we've had with Chairman Cox and the SEC commissioners, and the value the SEC staff has added to this initiative. Earlier this morning, I mentioned some of the important benefits of internal control over financial reporting and the accompanying audit. To preserve these benefits throughout the process of replacing auditing standard number 2, we've been careful to retain the fundamental principles that are essential to an effective internal control audit. By doing so, we've maintained our focus on the need for and right of investors to receive fairly stated financial statements and complete and accurate disclosure about the effectiveness of internal control. Before turning the discussion over to my colleagues, I'd like to highlight four aspects of the final standard that, in my opinion, will make a genuine difference and promote a balanced approach to the audit of internal control over financial reporting. First is a principles-based approach. In my view, principles-based audit standards are necessary to assure that the auditor, at every step of the audit process, can take into account the individual facts and circumstances of a particular company. Depending on the nature of the audit client, its control environment, the auditor may utilize different combinations of procedures. A principles-based standard gives the auditor room to exercise judgment in determining what specific procedures are required in order to obtain sufficient evidence. We've made an effort in developing AS5 to provide appropriate room for judgment, which is underscored by the top-down approach to the audit process. At the same time, the standard provides a sufficient framework to assure that an audit performed in accordance with its requirements will be effective. A principles-based standard has the flexibility to be scaled for an audit of a global company spanning several continents to a very small company. Second point is scalability. Scalability, in my mind, is closely tied to the principles-based approach. When developing the proposal, the board placed significant emphasis on assuring the scalability of the internal control audit. By incorporating the discussion of scaling concepts throughout the standard rather than one specific section, we've strengthened the impact of scaling. That is, the top-down, risk-based approach is fundamentally designed so that an auditor will tailor the design, to tailor the audit to the specific profile of a company. Smaller, which is to say non-accelerated filers, are still in the preparatory stage of complying with internal control requirements. I believe they will benefit from the scalability built into AS5, which will be reinforced by the guidance on auditing internal control in smaller companies that will be issued later this year. The third is fraud controls. Every company has an inherent level of fraud risk, and auditors must be cognizant of that risk in each audit. The proposed standard on auditing internal controls discussed fraud controls and the auditor's procedures related to these controls among the testing concepts included near the end of the standard. Based on comments received, there are several changes to the standard that Tom Ray and his team have just outlined. I strongly support the added emphasis we have given to fraud risk and anti-fraud controls in the final standard. This should make clear to auditors the importance of assessing fraud risk throughout the audit process. I support the move to incorporate the auditor's fraud risk assessment required in the financial statement audit into the auditor's planning process for the audit of internal control as well. This is another important way to promote audit quality and improve integration with the financial statement audit. While even the strongest of internal control frameworks cannot provide absolute assurance that fraud will be prevented or detected, a strong control environment should help to reduce instances of fraud. This emphasis on fraud controls and the internal control audit ultimately enhances investor protection. Fourth is aligning with the SEC management guidance. Yesterday, the SEC adopted guidance to help management evaluate internal control for purposes of its annual assessment. Management's assessment and the audit of internal control are distinct yet complementary steps in the Section 404 process of providing assurance to investors about the reliability of companies' internal control. Many of our commenters emphasize the importance of these steps being more closely aligned. While management process and the audit should work together, management and the auditor have different perspectives on the company's internal controls, and the assessment and audit have different objectives under Section 404. Therefore, I support the changes proposed by staff to better align AS5 and the SEC's management guidance. It is essential that general concepts necessary to an understanding of internal control are described in the same way. I'm pleased, therefore, by the decision to use the same definitions and terminology where relevant. Our work will not end today. We are well aware that adopting a balanced standard is only part of our overall initiative. Equally important is sound implementation once the board adopts its final standard. In the coming months, the board and staff from standards and inspections will work closely with audit firms on effective implementation of AS5. Our inspection program will be adjusted to be consistent with the new standard. Our intention in acting today is to have the new standard in place in time for the 2007 audits. We will continue to watch AS5 implementation carefully, in part because companies and the controls they use will evolve, and auditors will gain more experience and identify better, more effective ways to carry out their audits of internal controls. As with other standards, we must keep current so that our expectations remain reasonable. The new standards principles-based approach provides room for companies and auditors to evolve, and the board will work closely with its inspection staff to assure that we remain informed and allow for innovation. In sum, I support the adoption of the new standard as presented by the board today. It directs auditors on how to right-size the audit of internal control, which is expected to eliminate unnecessary work. Same time, it safeguards the important objectives of 404. I encourage those involved in the financial reporting process to hear our message today and move forward to implement the PCAOB's new audit standards as well as the SEC's management guidance in a manner that enhances governance over financial reporting and provides greater assurance to investors that financial reporting is fair and accurate. I will now turn to my fellow board members for any discussion. Mr. Gelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to make some comments and then ask the staff a few questions. Today's meeting brings to a close one chapter in the most far-reaching standard-setting project the PCAOB has undertaken in the 4.5 years that the board has been in operation. In conjunction with management assessments, internal control audits under auditing standard number 2 have had a profound effect on both public company financial reporting and on the way that audits are conducted. Companies have identified and corrected thousands of previously undetected deficiencies, and controls are undoubtedly stronger and better understood today than before Section 404 reporting took effect. At the same time, This process has proven highly controversial and certainly, in the opinion of some, unduly costly. Last December, the board proposed to replace auditing standard number 2 with a more risk-focused and principles-based approach to internal control auditing. The proposal the board published for comments sought to focus the auditor on the matters most important to control effectiveness, to eliminate unnecessary requirements and procedures, and to make the standard more workable for smaller companies. I think it's fair to say that the predominant view of the 175 comments the board received was that we were on the right track. Of course, the comments contained numerous and often contradictory recommendations for additional changes. Some people thought we'd gone too far in affording greater flexibility to tailor the audit to the issuer. Others argued we hadn't gone far enough. But the general concepts on which the new standard rests enjoyed wide support. Based on the comments, we've made some important further changes that were not originally incorporated in the proposal. The staff has already discussed many of these. I'd like to briefly highlight 5 that are, in my view, particularly noteworthy. First, the new standard retains as its organizing principle the top-down concept, under which the auditor focuses on entity-level controls and works downward, planning the audit so that testing of lower-level controls is influenced by the strengths and weaknesses of those above. But the new standard emphasizes that the approach is more one of reasoning rather than work sequence, and that the auditor needs to use judgment, not follow a roadmap. Second, the final standard underscores that walkthroughs, a process by which the auditor traces a transaction from cradle to grave through the company's financial reporting system, are not an end in themselves, but a means to attaining an understanding of likely sources of misstatement. This change reduces the risk that walkthroughs will become just another step that must be performed without much understanding as to why the work is being done. Third, the new standard requires the auditor to communicate to the audit committee control deficiencies identified during the audit that are less severe than material weaknesses, but important enough to merit the attention of those responsible for the company's financial reporting. This replaces the approach in auditing standard number 2, which relied on the auditor's ability to make difficult determinations about the application of abstract phrases like more than remote and more than inconsequential as applied to deficiencies. The standard puts the emphasis on the auditor's professional judgment and expertise. Fourth, similarly, the final standard rephrases the discussion of circumstances that are indicators of material weaknesses. The new version should increase the likelihood that material weaknesses will serve as an early warning system rather than merely as after-the-fact acknowledgments that something's gone wrong. Fifth, the final standard, like the proposal, affords the auditor greater latitude to use the results of testing performed by the company's internal audit or other staff. However, that goal is accomplished by referring the auditor to the familiar criteria in the existing auditing standard on use of the work of others, rather than by creating a new standard with new criteria. I believe these are positive changes, and that taken as a whole, the package the board is considering today will preserve the benefits of internal control auditing, while at the same time focus auditor energy and resources on the mountains rather than the molehills of internal control. I'm also optimistic that we've created a framework that can be applied to smaller, less complex companies in a way that matches costs and benefits. However, as I emphasized in my comments last December, there are limits to what we can accomplish through a new auditing standard. How a standard is implemented matters as much as how it's written. The board has said that it will use its inspection program to make sure that this standard is implemented in a way that is consistent with the board's objectives. We've also undertaken to develop guidance for internal control audits of smaller companies. Our success in making good on those promises will be critical, especially as the SEC brings smaller companies, the non-accelerated filers, into the internal control reporting and auditing regime. Many people have contributed to the success of this project, as the chairman's comments and Tom's indicate, and I'd like to join in thanking all of them. I particularly would like to thank the three people sitting in front of us, Tom Ray, Laura Phillips, and Sharon Virig, for their hard work and dedication. I don't think any of them joined the board to devote their careers to internal control auditing, but the commitment, enthusiasm, and sound judgment they've brought to this project have all been of immense value, not just to the board, but to the investing public. Special thanks go to Laura Phillips, who's been part of our chief auditor's office since almost the beginning, and has recently announced that she's going to be leaving the board for the corporate world. It's been a privilege and a pleasure to work with you, Laura, and you will be missed.
Thank you.
With that, I would like to ask about a couple of things. You've touched on some of them already. And first, as I said a minute ago, one of the main objectives of this revision, in my view, was to design or create a standard that would be workable for smaller public companies, both the smaller accelerated filers and the still smaller companies that aren't yet subject to the requirement. The proposal included a four-page section entitled Scaling the Audit for Smaller Public Companies that contained guidance on how the size and complexity of the company should influence the audit. When people look at the final standard, the standard we'll be releasing today, they'll see that 3.5-page, 4-page section has shrunken to one 3-sentence paragraph entitled Scaling the Audit. I have some concerns about what message people might take from that change in form, at least, of the standard. I wonder if you could comment on why we've changed the approach, at least the form of the approach, and what you think the practical implications will be.
Well, the section on scaling, Laura talked a little bit about it, but let me just talk a little bit more. The section on scaling, based on comments we received, we realized that several people pointed out to us that, one, it should apply to less complex in general. There could be less complex processes at a company, small, less complex units at a company, or small, less complex companies themselves, and that the principles in the standard really were what were driving, would drive the scaling effort. And so as we kind of looked through all of the scaling points that we had, what is the underlying principle, and identified where in the standard that underlying principle was, it seemed like it would make more sense as you're walking the auditor through the underlying principles to point out at that point, here's your scaling point related to that principle. And so we have taken what was in, I think it was only 3 or 4 paragraphs, but they were big ones, taken those, broken them apart, and integrated them into the audit so that as the auditor's working their way through the natural process of the audit and the flow of the standard follows that, they'll get to these points and be thinking about it in those stages. We've actually added a few integration points that weren't in there originally. It's hard to see it. Otherwise, it would get bigger by a small couple-line paragraph. But it definitely, all of the information, I think, that was in the original one is still in there. It's just spread out through the standard.